Welcome to Sharp Waves, a podcast from the International League Against Epilepsy. Our episodes cover epilepsy research, clinical care, career development, and issues in diagnosis and treatment from around the globe.
So thank you for joining us on this episode of Sharp Waves, where I'm joined by Dr. Ronnie Wikström from Stockholm, who is going to tell us about the International Consensus Recommendation for Management of New Onset Refractory Status Epilepticus and Febrile Infection-Related Epilepsy Syndrome. And I know there are two papers published. One is on summary and clinical tools, and then the other one on statements and supporting evidence.
Thanks for the opportunity to present these papers. So my name is Ronnie Wikström. I'm a pediatric neurologist and epileptologist in Stockholm in Sweden. I'm also a professor of child neurology here at Karolinska. And so my field has for a long time been working with neuroinflammatory diseases, both demyelinating diseases and also encephalitis cases of different kinds. And then I work with epilepsy. And these have been my two fields. And actually these two fields meet in FIRES. So that's how I came to start with this. I had a case, actually, this is 6 or 7 years ago, a FIRES case that really did not end well, of course, like they often do not do. He survived, but he had severe sequelae. And it sort of puzzled me, this whole FIRES thing. And I wasn't aware of FIRES until then. I'd heard of it, but this is an epilepsy phenotype, but where we believe that autoimmune or some sort of immunological, at least, components are involved. So that's where I came into it, because it sort of was where my two worlds met anyway. But when I started out, it started out as a FIRES discussion. And we in the pediatric field had some FIRES communities. And what's happened over the last couple of years, and which I've had the privilege to be involved in, is that this has merged together with the Norse community, which was also existing. So Norse was perceived as an adult disease and FIRES as a pediatric disease. And one of the things that we want to emphasize here is that that's probably not true. So one of the things that we were doing in the FIRES field, and I learned also was done in the Norse field, is that there's a lot of research trying to be done, but there's not, and there's data coming out, but it's very hard. These are hard areas to study. One is, of course, that this is new onset, which means that there's no population to study until they end up in a refractory status epilepticus. This is very rare. It's a rare and a very hyper acute thing, which means that if you try to set up clinical trials with standardized sampling and standardized testing and standardized treatment of these patients, it's extremely difficult, because you're in a hyperacute situation where you need to do everything for your patient. So designing trials is extremely difficult. We went through all the data that was published before we started this, and there's a lot of case series and case presentations, and even in the larger case series and the ones we've tried to compile, for instance, all the children that have been treated with IL-1 inhibition. And one of the lessons we learned from that was that even though we tried to standardize all the data when we looked at it, it really ended up being 26 children, 26 individuals. So it's really, really difficult. And that means that what you're left with as a clinician is there's not a lot of solid data to base anything on. And so what we wanted to do with this Delphi approach, which I had been part of another Delphi approach where we tried to summarize treatment in NMDA encephalitis. And so I thought that one way to do this, or to try to summarize what we do know and give some sort of recommendations, we've been careful not to call these guidelines or anything like that, because they're not, because we don't have any evidence to say that they are guidelines. These are recommendations, something to hold on to as a clinician and as a researcher. And we tried to compile this group of people that we thought, for one or another reason, were important to have as part of it, and compile recommendations that covered everything from what is Norse and FIRES, and also diagnostics and workup, over treatment and long-term treatment. And that's the second part of why we undertook this and why I thought it was important, is that it also provided a possibility to try to bring everyone together, because that's the next step here. If this is a very rare and hyperacute and complicated thing, we at least need to try to, I mean, we obviously need to study it better. And And we need large consortia to do this. And we need a common understanding, and we need to have common data elements, so we speak the same language, and we need to test standardized and things like that, even if these are only real-world studies. And so the second idea of bringing this together was to create a platform, like a ground, a solid ground. And this is the first step in that, to start a research consortium, international consortium, where we can do these studies.
Thank you. I understand that this ended up, there was a core group, and then there was a bigger group of expert panel of 48 people internationally. Of course, the Delphi method is quite interesting too, in that in this particular project, there was a pre-set of questions, and then it led to a stage one and a stage two.
Yeah, so the Delphi methodology is an interesting way of doing things. It's a standardized way of reaching a consensus. Basically, that's what that is. You can be very orthodox, and you could be less orthodox, and there are different ways of doing it. But the ground, the basic principle is the same. The idea is that rather than asking questions, you try to phrase statements like a recommendation or a guideline if you have enough data for that. And for statements where you reach a consensus, that's all fine. And in statements where you do not reach a consensus for some reason, the idea is then that you try to mold or adjust these statements until they are acceptable by the group as a consensus. So a couple of things here. One is, of course, that how do you select the group? How do you choose what group? How do you form the questions or the statements? And then what is a consensus? When is, 100% is obviously consensus, but is 70% a consensus? And there's no definition, no clear definition on this. But we chose the methods that have most often been used on how to do this. So a couple of things were unusual in this case. One is that for a Delphi process, having 48 experts is a very large group. It's almost impossible. Of course, this gives you so much input. And that's not the problem. The problem is, of course, that it's too much input, and trying to get a consensus and also trying to get all these people together is very, very difficult, of course. That also, the other side of that is, of course, that I think that the people on this group were perfect. I think we could have probably found 48 others too that should have been on this group. And looking at the representation, it's a heavily leaning towards Europe and North America. And there's a lot of great research coming out from Asia, for instance. And we have a suboptimal representations from both Japan and Korea and China and other places. And then what we did, which is also unusual, is that we had this initial question of we're dealing with two things, or there are two ways of slicing this if you want to. So we're dealing with adults and children, and should we, are the questions usable for both groups, or should we divide them? Also, then we're dealing with Norse and fires, and those are more or less the same, because most children were perceived at least to have fires and adults have Norse. So we wanted to ask the group, and we were actually divided on this, and this, we weren't sure, should we actually perform one Delphi, which is what we did, or should we divide it and do a pediatric and adult one? The reason we actually decided to go with the Delphi, one Delphi, is that we felt that there's not a whole lot of evidence supporting that this actually is a pediatric disease on one hand, and that Norse is another, completely different. In fact, a lot of evidence points to this being very overlapping or the same disease or condition. And if for nothing else, it's clear that the tradition of or the use of anti-inflammatory treatments in children, as for instance used IL-1 inhibition using anakinra, whereas in adults it's IL-6 inhibition, and in this case it was using tocilizumab. And there's no real reason for this. It's just that in adults this has been used more, and so it's just different traditions. And we felt that in this case, the differences, we can actually probably learn more from the differences from the adult and pediatric side that then it will cause a problem. Joining or defining fires as a part of Norse is actually, we corroborated that here, but that's in the definitions that it was published in 2019 and 18 even. So that wasn't nothing new, but it's important to emphasize that there's, if you look at adults with Norse in the Yale cohort, for instance, right now, their preliminary data show that more than half of the adult Norse patients actually fulfill FIRES criteria as well. And of course, conversely, there are children that don't fulfill FIRES criteria. But it's quite rare. It's obvious that the children are in children and the younger age in younger ages, the prevalence of an infection preceding the illness is much higher. It's not 100%, but it's getting there. The important things in this is to try to look at all kinds of NORS, including fires, as a potentially immunological problem, especially cryptogenic NORS case. I mean, if you have so NORS today is a condition, it can include infectious diseases and can include autoimmune diseases. And if you find that, of course, you treat that. But if you don't find that and you're stuck with it, so you have inconclusive results, cases of no etiology, we want to emphasize the importance of trying to break a vicious circle, which is probably, I'm not going to say it's inflammatory because it may not be inflammatory, but at least it's immunological. And that's been more used in the pediatric field because it's so obvious coming from a preceding illness that this could be some sort of activation, whereas that's not been the case in adults. And there are some data looking at refractory status epilepticus in adults showing that immunological treatments are not really on the table and definitely not as early as they should be. So to think that this is possibly immunologically, there's an immunological component in this and that you have to target that, because if you don't break that circle, none of your regular anti-seizure medications are going to work. But that's one of the things, to start early with a first-line immunotherapy and to escalate aggressively and early to second-line immunotherapies. The other thing that's also in this, which is not primarily immunological, is that we advocate use of ketogenic diet as early as possible. And that's also used in virtually all cases in pediatrics, but not so much in adults. And the reason for advocating that is that's one of the few treatments that have actually been shown in the small but still case series to be effective. And so we believe that that's adding ketogenic diet early, which is in this case was defined in the recommendations as 7 days, is of importance.
Thank you. What would be the implications of the results?
The important implication is to look at your local guidelines for how you treat status epilepticus and refractory status epilepticus in your hospitals. We can see, we haven't shown that here, but there's data showing that a lot of hospitals don't have clear guidelines on this. And the ones that do rarely include immunotherapy. So looking at these guidelines, this would affect your local guidelines for refractory status epilepticus and super refractory status epilepticus if these are new onset during the first week of treatment. And when it comes to workup and diagnostics, there's a lot of recommendations on how to do this. And this is also differs a little bit. We know that in pediatrics, for instance, we sometimes don't take all the antibodies that we should do. We know that in adults or in adult situations, it's perceived as not so important to look at genetics or metabolic disease, of course, because it's not as prevalent, but it should be part of your. So during the first couple of days during the workup, this is the implications of this of these papers is that it can give you recommendations on where to look and try to widen your screening. And then the big implication is, of course, the treatment implication that occurs from day three, which includes primary immunotherapy or first-line immunotherapy, and then escalating it by day seven.
Well, I think having those time frames arguably could be altering outcomes, especially when we're really dealing with, as you mentioned, you have one case and it will never leave you for the rest of your career. You're always trying to understand what you can do better. What would be the next steps of this very impressive consensus group?
So the next step everyone is dreaming about, which we were thinking a couple of years before, I mean, it's been a couple of years now that we've been thinking that this should have been started, is to have clinical trials of treatments. It's very, very difficult, it turns out. It's difficult to agree upon if we do a treatment, how do we do it? Is it a head-to-head treatment? And if so, what do we use? It's going to be really, really hard to design those trials at this point. I don't think we have enough data for anyone, because you as a treating clinician, you need to treat your patient the way you think is best. It's hard to randomize patients too hard. So you have to have a compliance from the group. And that was part of the reason for actually doing this, to increase the compliance and let everyone have a say in how to design these clinical trials. I'm hoping that we can fairly soon arrive at clinical trials. But I also think that we need to think differently than that, and looking at how can we design real life studies that are usable. For instance, can we look at some sort of clinical decision support that can serve both the purpose of filling up a biobank of both data and possibly samples at the same time as it offers you as a clinician help. What I hope this work that we've done has created is to create an awareness in this group and in other groups that there is a consortium or there will be a consortium, and this is open. The more people that want to join, the better, the stronger we can get. And we can use this to do good research, to get funding to do research, and also to try to help these children and adults. And hopefully expand into refractory status epilepticus, because it's one debate now is what actually differs. Why is NORS different from other refractory status epilepticus? And that's a valid question. And I think that in many cases it will be. For instance, if you have structural some sort of etiologies, or if you have an ongoing epilepsy or something like that before, then that's probably a different sort. But immunological components may be a part even in that case. But I think what NORS as a concept offers is it sort of offers an umbrella that can help us in forwarding and advancing our knowledge. And maybe in 2 years or 5 or 10 years, we'll decide that there is no such thing as NORS. It's just refractory status epilepticus. It just happens to be new onset, and we understand what it is.
Lastly, and second last question would be about the CSF cytokines. And I'm very intrigued that it made it to the consensus. Of course, it's been a bit point of debate for two reasons. One is for clinical availability in terms of using reliable labs that can give you clinical turnaround time as quickly as you would like to use it as a biomarker to guide treatment. And then the other one is always timing, I find, just because the cytokine profiles can change quite drastically. And I see there were two questions in the consensus. One, whether it would be used for biomarker of disease progression and response to treatment. And then the other one was a choice of medication.
So one of the hypotheses concerning FIRES and also NORS is that it at least involves, maybe it's not the whole mechanism, but it involves cytokine release, and that is in that part of the immunological activation that's actually the problem. And there is some evidence to support that from animal data, and also there's evidence in humans from blocking both IL-1 and IL-6 mainly, and with good results. So that's the idea of why cytokines appear to be important. Now, just as you mentioned, there are several problems with cytokines. One, of course, is that it's hugely complex. It's really a web of different cytokines, and they affect each other. For instance, we know that IL-1, which is a regulator of the pro-inflammatory system, is we hardly ever see it because it has a very short half-life. Just by looking at all data that we have for IL-1, for instance, you would never use an IL-1 blocker. That would be the logical result of that, because, and still we know that it works. Looking at IL-1 levels doesn't really help. The second problem with cytokines is that they're hard to analyze, perhaps if you don't have access to that lab, but they're also hard to sample. Whereas antibodies are very stable, cytokines are not stable. So you really, if you don't sample it the right way, for instance, from the start, then you go to your bacterial or your microbiology lab and say, do you have any CSF left? And that's been standing on the lab bench for 2 hours, and that means cytokines have degenerated. I would love to say that you should look at cytokines and you should use that, but we don't know that. But tentatively, if we believe that cytokines are involved in this, then it should be possible to, or it could be possible to look to have both as a marker of disease and also as disease progression. But just like you said, it's not a question of it. This goes up and then it goes down and then it's gone. Inflammation is a tricky thing, because it's an endogenous response that you want to have. And one of the consequences of a pro-inflammatory response, which is, because if we say inflammation, we usually mean pro-inflammation, that it becomes. The other thing is we have an anti-inflammation, and the pro-inflammatory cytokines will increase an anti-inflammatory response. And we know, for instance, in studies of encephalitis cases, is that you really need to look at the ratio between pro and anti-inflammatory to understand it.
For the young clinician researchers listening, how can they get more involved with this type of research? Are there any organization or consensus groups within the ILAE or within this consortium that they could approach and explore being more involved in likes of this research?
Right now, this consortium that I'm referring to isn't really a consortium. It's something we want to evolve into more of a consortium, but people are there and it's open, 100% open. So everyone who wants to join, both from a learning perspective and because this is an area that you want to contribute in, is fantastic. One way of accessing this or being able is via the Norse Institute. And that's the norseinstitute.org. It's a North American institute that was started by one of a mother of a patient that actually died from this. And she's done a fantastic job in trying to promote this research and bringing all of us together. There you can find the names and the email addresses of many who's been part of this. And that's we also regularly update that with all the published literature and also where you can find your way to the different ongoing studies. And that's a way in.
And to conclude, I'd like to ask if there's anything more that you'd like to add, and most importantly, any take-home messages that we want to leave our listeners with. Thank you.
I really, really want to emphasize the immunological treatment because I can see that's not working perfectly, of course not, but it could be improved a lot in kids, but even more so in the adults because they're not using immunological treatments at all. And I'm convinced that it will help so many adults with Norse and fires, probably both Norse and fires. That's the important take-home message.
Thanks for listening to Sharp Waves. Our content is meant for informational purposes only and not as medical or clinical advice. The International League Against Epilepsy is the world's preeminent association of health professionals and scientists working toward a world where no person's life is limited by epilepsy. Find more Sharp Waves episodes wherever you get your podcasts or at ilae.org.